Signet Classics, which currently publishes George Orwell's 1984, reports that sales have increased over 9,500% since President Trump disputed the crowd size at his inauguration. And his counsel to the president, Kellyanne Conway, told Chuck Todd on Meet the Press that the assertions about the size of the Inauguration Day crowd were alternative facts. The renewed interest in Orwell may be a reflection of fears for the future of liberal democracies around the world. In his latest book, Churchill and Orwell, The Fight for Freedom, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Thomas E. Ricks explores the writings of these two men when their generation worried about the threat of totalitarianism. It's published by Penguin Press. I'm very pleased it has brought Thomas E. Ricks back to our show. Hi, welcome back.
Thanks. Good to be back.
What got you thinking about writing a biography, a joint biography of Winston Churchill and George Orwell? They never met.
They never met. They admired each other from afar. Remember, the hero of 1984 is named Winston. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the last thing Orwell ever wrote and published from his hospital bed was an admiring review of the second volume of Churchill's war memoirs. That said, though, they are very different people. Churchill's an imperialist conservative, usually extroverted, and Orwell is a socialist and an introvert.
But they had certain things in common. They, first of all, they both had served as war correspondents.
As I did, which is one of the things that got me interested. As to your question as to what pulled me into it, Orwell especially, was about 4 years ago. I was, for just my own interest, sitting down and reading a lot of 20th century journalism. And I was wondering why so much of it seemed so stale and out of date and didn't speak to our times, H.L. Mencken being the best example of the people I read. But even E.B. White, whose prose style I like, didn't seem to really be about our times, nor Hemingway, nor S.J. Perlman, who I simply didn't find funny. Yet, when I picked up Orwell, it was stunning to me. This was a fresh voice. It seemed contemporary. And I began to wonder why that was. And when I looked at Orwell and Churchill, who are really my two heroes in life, I began to see that for all their differences, they were right about one big thing in the 1930s when so many people were wrong. They said, the majority was saying, democracy is dead. Your choice now is fascism or communism. And Orwell and Churchill, from their very different perches, say no. We need to preserve a space for the individual in society. We need to protect freedom of conscience, freedom of speech, freedom of association from the increasingly intrusive state.
They both had wonderful styles, probably because they had worked as journalists of a certain sort. Didn't Churchill actually parlay his reporting the Boer War in South Africa into his political career? He'd been kidnapped, and that had become a big story?
He was taken prisoner of war, had an escape, and really rode it to fame and then used that to launch his political career. So while they were both war correspondents, they had very different approaches to what they were trying to do.
But he had ups and downs. And by 1929, the conservatives were voted out of office, and Churchill's personal finances were a disaster. Because of the crash or because of other factors?
Yeah, he's put a lot of money into Wall Street and, in fact, was trying to recover his finances. He's on Fifth Avenue here in New York City when he was hit by a taxi cab.
He's part American.
And half American, but he was nearly killed on Fifth Avenue when he looked the wrong way crossing the street, and I think distracted by his political disasters. What we forget about Churchill is for most of his political career, he was a failure. He really had one great year, that 1940, the Battle of Britain, Dunkirk, when he took office and gave those great speeches whose phrases we still remember.
But he also seemed to be right about a lot of things during those early years. He may have been wrong about things later. But for example, there was a lot of sympathy for fascism and even Hitler among the British aristocracy. And Churchill from the start is anti-authoritarian.
Churchill in the 1930s is absolutely right, but as a politician, he was a failure. He was an exile. He called it the political wilderness.
Because he was going against his own party, the policy of appeasement he
exactly.
was opposed to.
Appeasement was the belief, and it was what the smart folk thought. Remember, this was the majority view. It was the official policy of Great Britain and the Conservative Party and the King, that we can cut deals with these Nazis. Sure, they're a bunch of gangsters, but we can feed them little bits. And that'll take the care of the problem. And anyways, if we fought, we'd fight alone. And that would be no good. So the smart move is to bargain with Hitler.
And then we have Orwell, who reported from the Spanish Civil War and wrote, "One of the dreariest effects of this war has been to teach me that the left-wing press is every bit as spurious and dishonest as that of the right."
It's one of my favorite quotes from Orwell. The great transformation of Orwell is he goes to Spain in 1936 to see the Spanish Civil War. He goes there a pretty conventional leftist. He emerges still a socialist. It's a myth that he moved to the right or became a neoconservative or something. But he emerges very skeptical of anyone in power telling you what the facts are and very wary of official policies and views and parties on the left and the right.
He said, "In Spain, for the first time, I saw newspaper reports which did not bear any relation to the facts."
Bingo. Sounds like fake news, right?
Yeah. But it is interesting that his Animal Farm was published in England on August 1945, just months after the Allied victory against the Nazis. It's an allegory about the dangers of Stalinism, shaped, I guess, by his experiences in the Spanish Civil War.
And by his observation generally of World War II, he saw Britain in decline, and he saw America rising and the Soviet Union rising, and was sort of projecting this world, first in Animal Farm and then in 1984.
So we have these two men who Orwell says that Churchill is the only man, the only conservative he respects. But there was widespread support in Britain for appeasing Hitler. I mentioned that. Why was he convinced that appeasement was the wrong – Churchill convinced that appeasement was the wrong idea?
Churchill on appeasement said, you can't negotiate from a position of weakness and expect to win. Churchill said the facts of the matter – and he was always about the facts on this. He'd get up again and again in the 1930s, really seen as a washed-up, isolated figure, and he'd say the facts of the matter is Germany is rearming. And his party did not want to hear the facts of the matter. They regarded him as really a turncoat within the party.
On the other hand, there's a new film called Churchill, which portrays the prime minister in the days leading up to the Allied D-Day landings in Normandy in June 1944. And he comes across as an impossibly difficult man as he is clashing with General Eisenhower and the British Field Marshal Montgomery. And partly the explanation is that he remembered Gallipoli and his role in the loss of all the lives in Gallipoli and then what he had seen throughout World War One, and didn't realize that World War II was a very different animal.
And it was very painful for him because they were seeing the Americans ascendant. The Americans came into the war in 1941 with the British kind of saying, look, we've been in this war 2 years, let us tell you how to fight it. And then in a very short period, by the middle of 1944, the Americans have surpassed the British in fighting effectiveness, efficiency. They simply are better at fighting the war. And at the same time, it's very painful. Churchill is realizing we're going to lose the empire and we are going to take second. We're going to emerge from this war a second-rate power. The Americans, by late 44, aren't even listening to the British anymore.
My guest is Thomas E. Ricks, his latest book, Churchill and Orwell, The Fight for Freedom. There's also the matter of the British class system, which breaks down at least for a little while during World War II. And Churchill is part of that process.
And Churchill observes it. Churchill was a great observer of the details of the war, and much in the same way that Orwell was. And Churchill, at one point, asked for details on how many aristocratic boys have risen to become pilots in the Royal Air Force. And he realizes that it was the middle class that was flying the airplanes of the IRF that won the Battle of Britain and prevented a German invasion in 1940. And he actually says the middle class is winning and has saved the nation, and they deserve to run it. Orwell was hoping early on for a political revolution, later decides in a very honest piece he writes, I was wrong about the war bringing a revolution. But actually, there was a social revolution even before World War II ends in the Pacific. Churchill is voted out of office in July 1945. A Labor Party takes power.
Clement Attlee.
And initiates the welfare state that Orwell had wanted.
Now, Orwell had also said, England is the most class-ridden country under the sun. It is a land of snobbery and privilege ruled largely by old and silly. So what happened? Why do you think they never did meet?
I think they would have enjoyed meeting. In fact, I have a piece that ran today online in which I imagine Churchill and Orwell meeting in heaven. I think they didn't meet because Orwell was an introvert and a bit of a crank, increasingly isolated in his later life. He actually moves from London to an island off of Scotland in the Inner Hebrides at the end of a trackless island, really withdrawing from the world and actually a little bit paranoid, worried that Stalin was going to have him killed, as many of Orwell's friends were killed by the Russian NKVD in Spain.
Have people been asking you much about what's in the book or about what's going on right now? Because you also write about the current situation. There is that link I mentioned at the beginning, the whole matter of facts, which was so important to Orwell, and he wrote a lot about, especially in Animal Farm, about how facts can be adjusted.
Well, I think the 1930s feel a little bit like today, a time of political turmoil, disequilibrium. We have now in power the most reactionary president I think we've ever had. We are getting a whiff of authoritarianism. This is a president who either disregards or doesn't know the U.S. Constitution. And there's a whiff of 1984 in him. Winston Smith, the hero of the novel, named after Winston Churchill, by the way.
And we're talking about 1984.
Has a job. People remember that his job is to discard facts. He has at the end of his desk the memory hole in which facts that the government no longer likes are done away with. But part of his job also is to dumb down the language, much as President Trump's vocabulary has done. One of the things that Orwell talks about in the novel, they do away with the words splendid and excellent and replace them with good, double good, and double plus good, which reminds me a lot of the way Trump talks.
You've written 5 books about the military and America's wars. Have you had contact with so many of the people who are currently in the government? James Mattis, H.R. McMaster. What about Michael Flynn? Did you know him?
I know all those people. I've written about all those people. I think Mattis has appeared in 3 of my books, McMaster in at least one. Unfortunately, one of my burdens is that I helped General Flynn become famous. I know them.
Are you surprised by what we've been learning?
Yes, I am. I didn't think that General Flynn was the brightest bulb on the circuit, but I didn't think he would have done what he appears to have done, lied apparently or allegedly in the course of being vetted for office, taking money from the Russians, things like this. That
kind of shocked
me. I've known H.R. McMaster since he was a relatively young officer. I think I first encountered his wife when he was a captain, and I first sat down and talked to H.R. McMaster when he was a major. And I have to say, watching him over the last 10 days has been rather painful for me.
You've blogged about his press conference after it was alleged that the president revealed classified intel to the Russian ambassador Sergei Kislyak and foreign minister Sergei Lavrov. What did you make of that?
I was surprised to see McMaster, whose job as national security advisor is to protect the nation, instead seeking to protect the president. I was surprised to see him quibble about the truth. First he says the story is false. The next day he says, I meant to say the story's premise is false. I don't even know what that means. McMaster is not just any general, and he's a very smart guy, but he's not just any smart general. He wrote the book, Dereliction of Duty, on the failure of senior military officers during the Vietnam War to tell the truth, as they saw it, to the president. So there's a Shakespearean quality to seeing H.R. McMaster stand up and go down the same road that he condemned in his book.
And many people are saying he is damaging his legacy. But we've seen that.
I think he's selling pieces of his soul, frankly.
getting back to Churchill, he damaged his legacy as well when he returned to politics.
Yeah, Churchill went out like a chump in July 1945, with bad thinking, ran for office again and had a second term as prime minister in the early 1950s. He was an old, tired man. He was having strokes. He had no business being in office, and I suspect he knew it.
How old was Orwell when he died?
Orwell was a young man. He died early in 1950 at the age of 47.
Mm-hmm.
Really an unknown. His last two books, 1984 and Animal Farm, were bestsellers, but that really comes in the last few years of his life. And one of the amazing things about Orwell's career is that his fame after he dies, he's a much bigger figure now in our own times than he ever was in his own times.
Although it was ironic that we had 1984. 1984 came and went. We could just as easily say 2034, put that title on the book, and it probably would be a better prophecy. He thought it was going to come sooner than it may come.
Well, he wrote the book in 1948, and so I think he just reversed the numerals and said, look, this is in the future.
Are you surprised that the book is selling so well?
My book or...
book and 1984.
I'm pleased my book is selling. Orwell just keeps chugging along. I think the great surprise is a lot of people, even his supporters and critics like Harold Bloom, thought that 1984 was a period piece, like Uncle Tom's Cabin, that was tied to a specific piece of history. The surprise has been that once the Cold War ended, 1984 and Animal Farm were seen to be actually not just Soviet-specific, but actually were about the abuse of power generally. And they have a real popularity now in the Third World.
The reason I ask is because, to some degree, people are seeing connections with the thinking of politicians and writers of the past with what's going on today. Do we just keep on going through certain cycles?
I think the key question of the 20th century that Churchill and Orwell both perceived was, what do you do about the intrusiveness of the state into private and individual lives?
Well, now we know that the state can read all of our emails, listen to all our telephone calls. Are we finally at that point?
We are not just at that point, but we're finding corporations are doing the same things with our lives.
Thomas E. Ricks, Pulitzer Prize winner. His latest book is called Churchill and Orwell, The Fight for Freedom. It's published by Penguin Press. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you.
It's always a pleasure to see you.
Good to be back.